and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the prominent Republican Senator Bob Corker sounding the alarm today that Trump hasn't demonstrated the stability or competence to be successful and that radical changes are needed at the White House. An expert on the GOP, conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, race and elections, Joseph Lowndes, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, joins us. We will discuss the despair being expressed by the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at a time when President Trump is defending neo-Nazis, one of whom mowed down pedestrians with his car in Charlottesville, killing Heather Heyer, at a time when similar terrorist acts for which the Islamic State have claimed credit have taken place in Barcelona, where a van mowed down tourists, killing 13 and injuring 50. We'll discuss Trump's focus on Confederate statues at a time when moral leadership in renouncing acts of terrorism is needed both at home and abroad. Then we'll speak with Leonard Zeskind, who is the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights and author of Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream. He joins us to discuss the changing face of white nationalism and neo-Nazism in America with clean-cut, college-educated leaders like Richard Spencer exploiting the fear of demographic changes that will make whites a minority in this country to inflame the anxiety that simply being born white will no longer confer privilege. Then finally, now that President Trump, who ran as a businessman who would attract the best and brightest of America's CEOs to his administration, had to preemptively disband his White House Manufacturing Council and the Strategic and Policy Forum before an exodus of CEOs abandoned it, we will speak with the Executive Director of Color of Change, Rashad Robinson. He has led the effort for some time to persuade America's top CEOs who joined the president's councils to ensure that Trump's actions comport with their own corporate cultures, which stress inclusion, diversity, and tolerance. And joining us now is Joseph Lowndes, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, the GOP, race, and elections. He's the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origin of Modern Conservatism, and co-editor of Race and American Political Development. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Lowndes.
Thanks for having me.
And today, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker, fired a pretty massive shot across Trump's bow, basically saying that he hasn't demonstrated the stability and competence to be successful and that radical changes are needed inside the White House. And of course, we've had this horrendous attack, which ISIS is claiming credit for, in Barcelona, where 13 people have been mowed down and 50 injured. And you just can't help recognizing the horrible symmetry there between what happened in Charlottesville with the car ramming down protesters and killing Heather Heyer and this latest attack, in the sense that they're both terrorism, and yet President Trump went out of his way not to use the word domestic terrorism and to assign blame to all sides or many sides. And yet, of course, he's jumped on this situation in Barcelona and tweeted off this bizarre tweet about how Black Jack Pershing, General Pershing, took care of Islamic terrorists in the Philippines. And, of course, the myth is that he dipped bullets in pig's blood before he shot them all and left one of them alive to go back and tell his comrades that Black Jack Pershing meant business. So, do you feel the kind of despair, Joseph, that Senator Corker clearly feels, that we really need some leadership in this country?
Well, I think, you know, I've probably been despairing for quite some time, like many, many Americans and many people around the world, because of this presidency. So, I think there's, in some ways, there's a remarkable consistency about Trump and his comments today and his comments over the last few days, you know, in terms of both his relationship to white nationalism at home and how he perceives the Muslim world abroad. So I think, you know, these things are that have come more sharply into focus or have become more sharply into focus, partly as, you know, as you raised, you've got these two acts of terrorism that look very much like each other in Barcelona and in Charlottesville within the last week, and the stark differences in how they, how Trump himself has responded to it. I mean, one interesting thing about Corker, I think, is that this has really become a major crisis for the Republican Party and the Republican leadership itself. And, you know, Corker's also probably responding to this Steve Bannon phone call to Robert Kuttner from the American Prospect yesterday, where he, you know, went on a long conversation about the alignments he needs to make within the White House and outside the White House and how to deal with China, and, you know, kind of an extraordinary interview that normally a major White House official would never dream of having with a member of the media, particularly with a member of the media to whom he has, in the past and recent past, been quite hostile. So I think that has to be, for Corker, this has to be quite alarming as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I mean, this is for the American empire. This is really bad news. And I think, you know, for the Republican Party, Trump is really, really pushing this question of what's going to happen to the future of the party. And he's been denounced by a number of party leaders over the last week because of his comments concerning Charlottesville. But, you know, they're in a bind because if they cut Trump loose, if they go after him, he has a very remarkably loyal base that got him in office to begin with. So there's no good options for the Republicans, but I think that they now are feeling quite torn with this, you know, Frankenstein's monster they helped create over time, I think.
And I think the same applies of cutting Bannon loose from the White House, isn't that Trump doesn't want to cut him loose because he's better off inside the tent urinating out than outside the tent urinating in, as LBJ once said.
Right. I think that's true. You know, one thing about Bannon is that what Bannon has kind of kept the White House focused on, he and other, you know, partly, I think the thing that really that marks the Trump administration, just as it's marked the campaign from the day he came down the escalator and announced his candidacy, is a commitment to white racial power in America. And that's the thing that he has come back to over and over, and that's the overriding theme that, you know, that got him elected to begin with. So I think, you know, one of the things that Bannon's been very consistent with, as has Jeff Sessions as head of the Justice Department, is to continually hammer at questions of the anxieties of white Americans, whether it's immigration, whether it's so-called crime, whether it's, you know, welfare, whether it's, you know, these other issues that are things that kind of keep that base together. And that's the kind of thing that they have a quite steady hand on. What, you know, Bannon will call it economic nationalism, and for him it's tied to protectionism. It's tied to his desire to have a trade war with China, which, you know, all this comes back to a kind of a Buchananite political formation or worldview from the 90s. But I think that's, you know, another reason to keep Bannon in there is that he has, you know, as Trump has failed almost everywhere else, he has continually delivered the goods on in the areas that he's least constrained in, and this is within the Justice Department. Questions of immigration, questions of border security, questions of now the Civil Rights Commission going after affirmative action. These areas where Trump can be relatively unconstrained in going after kind of a, you know, racial imperative, let's say, which is really always, it's continual, you know, the base continually needs care and feeding, and this is what they're giving them. So there's a way in which having Bannon stay in the White House actually does, in some ways, I think, ironically, he's kind of the, you know, the sober-minded racist that's keeping the whole thing together in some ways.
Well, what a depressing thought. And again, I'm speaking with Joseph Lowndes, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, race and elections, and the GOP. He's the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and co-editor of Race and America, Political Development. Now, you just mentioned that Donald Trump's fanning the flames of white anxiety, particularly the fear of demographic changes that will make whites a minority in this country, and in a sense inflaming the anxiety that simply being born white will no longer confer privilege, and that does seem to be motivating those neo-Nazis and white supremacists who strutted their stuff in their assault rifles in Charlottesville. But given the demographic changes, it's going to get worse for those people if they have that mindset, right? And so are we to expect more trouble in this country?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at it from the perspective of the Republican Party, that's exactly the dilemma that they realize they face. And they've got two choices. One is to double down on race, and which they will always continue to do to some degree by pursuing forms of voter suppression and other ways of kind of keeping the electorate as white as possible. But, you know, they also know they are in a changing world, and they, in some ways, certain versions of racism are both bad for business and bad for empire. You know, there's this article in the New York Times today that you have, you know, top military leaders denouncing, you know, the stuff that's going on with Trump, and you've got the, you know, the business roundtable, which has been disbanded, and, you know, people at Pepsi and Walmart, they know that they have a broader demographic America that they have to serve, you know, as well. So I think that, you know, there is, you know, I think when Trump made those comments, his series of tweets about Charlottesville, I think what he, the gamble that he was taking is to say that there's going to be plenty of white Americans who think that these Confederate symbols are benign, that there's no reason to take them down, that they cause no offense, and that there's really not a no real problem with them, and so there's no reason to remove them. And so if you, you know, by saying, on the one hand, trying to, you know, denounce the far-right neo-Nazis, but then say you've got all these other people of goodwill who were there just to protect, you know, American symbols, and then really go after and demonize the anti-racists and anti-fascists who were there, I think what he's hoping is to, you know, kind of hold on to this broad, you know, broad white racial middle America, which is not quite, you know, which is not the Richard Spencers of the world, but they are people who are ill at ease with demographic changes that are coming down the pike.
And your book, From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, Joseph Lowndes, basically tells the story of the alliance between Southern segregationists and Northern conservatives, and how racial change in the South opened the door to conservative mobilization, and how this cross-regional alliance of white supremacists and business-oriented anti-New Dealers fundamentally reoriented American politics. How then can you keep that alive, as they appear to be doing, and focus on now it's down to 35%? Admittedly, it's a little under 80% of the Republicans, apparently, but overall, you would think that the 65% of Americans should be able to assert themselves politically. So what is the strategy here to keep pandering to the angry white minority afraid of the demographic changes?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, partly what happened to the Republican Party is, you know, after having reached kind of you know, the peak of the Southern strategy, which I would argue kind of went through George H.W. Bush's first presidential campaign in 1988 when Lee Atwater ran the Willie Horton ads. These are the ads that featured a furloughed black convict in Massachusetts that Michael Dukakis, as governor, the Democratic governor of Massachusetts and the Democratic presidential candidate, the attempt was to stick him and the Democratic Party with an image of blackness and crime and rape in a way that would demonize the party generally. And so probably what happened is after that was kind of the high point, or the kind of the end point, let's say, of that kind of politics for that moment. When George W. Bush ran 2000, he and the people around him hoped, I think, to create a more multicultural party. At the, you know, the convention in 2000, it was a mostly white audience, but you had a very multicultural presence on the stage of the convention. And then, you know, his cabinet was by far the most racially diverse cabinet that the U.S. had ever had, any president had had. And you had people of color prominent was placed in the office of two black secretaries of state, for instance. And so you had, you know, the party kind of shifting in a direction that they hoped would open it up towards kind of a multicultural future. And you had even Tea Partiers, even down the road by the time you got to the end of that decade, who were well, you know, represented by people like Tim Scott, an African-American from South Carolina, Alan West in Florida, Nikki Haley in South Carolina, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. And there was a sense that the Republican Party was really going to become a multicultural party. And Bush did extraordinarily well with Latino voters as well. And then, you know, once Obama won twice, by the time he won a second time, Republicans became quite anxious about really making sure that they were going to present a multicultural face to America after that. They had this famous meeting, now called the autopsy, after Romney lost, and tried to figure out how they were going to present the face of a party that didn't look like just old, angry white men. And that was really where political candidacies looked like they were going, or presidential candidacies looked like they were going for 2000, you know, for the last presidential election. And the base was, you know, angry and alienated for a number of reasons. I mean, partly we have an era where you have, you know, scholars call it the second Gilded Age. We have the kind of widest, you know, gap in wealth in this country that we've had since the, you know, 1880s, 1890s. And so partly you have diminished white expectations in terms of wages and employment. And whites still doing better than everyone else, but relatively, whites began to feel that they were doing worse. And so there's a way to kind of take those economic anxieties and racialize them. The relationship between race and class has always been very tightly linked in the United States. And so there's ways to talk about people's sense of abandonment as racial abandonment. And Trump was able to, you know, really hit that note. And it was, you know, it was again this Buchananite rhetoric, Pat Buchanan from his campaigns in 92 and 96, which came roaring back in this era. And surprised all the other, Republican political strategists and politicians and people at the RNC and everything else. And so you ended up with this situation where the Republican Party was committed through Trump to severe white racial reaction again. And so I think that Republican Party has been yanked in this direction in a way that I think none of them thought they were going to be. But what were they going to do once you had this strong support for Trump all the way across the primary season, and then in the general election, and then he wins? There's really not much they can try to pull the party in a different direction, but if they do, they risk losing a large part of their base, and then they go into the wilderness for quite some time. So I think that that's why you see these continual awkward gestures by people in Republican leadership in terms of their relationship to, you know, this is just, in some ways, these tweets around Charlottesville are only the latest version of things we've seen over and over again, and there's no answer to it, and so Republicans are going to continue this pattern. It may be that we've reached a tipping point now, after Charlottesville, with major elements of the ruling class and capital seeming to abandon him in the White House. And so that may make a difference. But you still, again, you've got that electoral base that has to be fed in some ways. And so I think, you know, it's a problem for them in a way that I think they've got no easy way out of.
Well, but just in closing, they have elected, or the American people, or at least a minority of them, have elected this extraordinarily unqualified, dangerous, and incompetent person who even a very moderate guy within his own party has said that Trump has not demonstrated that he understands what has made this nation great and what it is today. And he's got to demonstrate the characteristics of a president who understands that, and that radical changes are needed within the White House, and the president has not yet been able to demonstrate the stability, which I think is a real dig, or some of the competence that he needs to be successful. So there you have it. You know, I mean, that's a polite version of reality. We saw the mask come off a couple of days ago, and who this guy really is in private.
So. Yeah, I think that's right. But I think particularly for them, Republicans can absorb a lot of racism and a lot of whites. Remember, they built this house that they all live in now in some ways. But I think, again, this issue of when it comes to questions of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. power in the world and questions of corporate power, those are the two things that become real you know, real points of vulnerability and sensitivity for Republican elites and, you know, and for American elites generally. So I think that if there's any time when Trump has seemed vulnerable, probably now is the time because, you know, people have begun to abandon him, not just in the Republican Party, but again, in terms of corporate leadership and major elements of the military.
Well, Joseph Lowndes, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joseph Lowndes, a professor of political science at the University of Oregon and an expert on conservatism, the Tea Party, social movements, race and elections, and the GOP. He's the author of From the New Deal to the New Right, Race and the Southern Origins of Modern Conservatism, and co-editor of Race and American Political Development. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the changing face of white nationalism and neo-Nazism in America.
Not a poor Ku Klux man, see that we all brothers. Not cause things the same, because we lack the same color. And that's gray, now that's Maine. Can't burn his cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman strapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Leonard Zeskind, who is the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who has worked for more than three decades to curb the influence of racism, anti-Semitism, and white supremacist groups in the United States, and is a lifetime member of the NAACP. He's the author of Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream, and he has an article at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, Standing at the Crossroads, an analysis of events in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leonard Zeskind.
Well, thank you for bringing me on.
And your books, Blood and Politics, of course, has been a very important compendium of history from World War II to the present of these white supremacist and racist groups in the United States. And it's in effect the definitive history of white nationalism. But what explains this resurgence of racist politics in this country? The subtitle of your book, White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream, well, with people like Richard Spencer and the people that showed up in Charlottesville, they're not your normal tattooed, shaved head thugs. These guys look like the neighborhood accountant.
Well, and actually, in my book, Blood and Politics, I show you the leadership of the white nationalist movement. And it's lawyers, chiropractors, professors. It's never been the caricature that most Americans have of these characters. So the image that we have in the popular mind is not the actual fact. And Richard Spencer carries on that tradition, and he's moving his movement into the mainstream, and that's why I think he's looking a little better and not shouting white power, but shouting, you will not replace us.
Well, but you point out, though, that these atrocities, similar to what happened in Charlottesville, have happened throughout our history. And
you bet. You bet. They got real bad in the 80s when the white nationalists, white supremacists declared war. They got worse in the 90s. Remember Tim McVeigh and Oklahoma City bombing? And then it eclipsed. And then in the period during the Barack Obama presidency, white nationalists sort of lost their way. They didn't know what to make of a black president. The Tea Party picked up the action. But the white nationalists, quite frankly, were lost. In the last 2 years of that presidency, they picked up. And they've picked up in the years since. It's become clear that white people are becoming a minority in a nation of minorities. They're used to white majority status, white power, white privilege, and they want it back. So they're scheming about how to create a white republic.
And isn't most of these atrocities that they commit and these public displays of their extraordinary, I mean, it's so difficult for me to get my head around the idea that you have people out there in this country celebrating this genocidal maniac, Adolf Hitler, who killed at least 50 million people. And then you have the other heroes in their mind on these pedestals in these monuments throughout their country of the Confederacy and the people like Robert E. Lee who were traitors to this country and led this country into a bloody civil war that cost at least 800,000 lives in terms of the soldiers on both sides and tore this country apart. How could these people be role models for anybody?
Well, they're not role models for you and me, certainly. And the actual poll data shows that white men in the South in particular adore the Confederacy. It's a symbol of white resistance for them. So it has a contemporary meaning. When the Sons of Confederate veterans say, oh, we're into heritage, not hate. Well, that heritage, of course, is the heritage of holding slaves. And the Confederacy, I might remind you, wrote the preservation of white supremacy into their constitution. So there's no heritage or hate. It's just racist white supremacy. It's been part of the United States of America since the very beginning, and they're carrying it on, unfortunately.
Well, but our president, Donald Trump, is carrying it on. Today he tweeted out, sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, who's next? Washington, Jefferson. So foolish. Also, the beauty that is being taken out of our cities, towns, and parks will be greatly missed and never able to be comparably replaced.
Well, look, anybody who does not understand that Donald Trump has been a recognizable racist ever since he challenged Barack Obama's birthright citizenship. You remember, this is the guy that ran around saying Barack Obama is not a natural born American. Of course he wasn't. He was black. So he hasn't had a brain on this issue for a long time. It's a shame that he was became the president. He didn't win the election. Remember, he was appointed by the crazy system we have of delegates.
The Electoral College, right?
The Electoral College. So, look, I the one thing that we don't want to do here, we don't want to confuse the fact that these white nationalists, these white supremacists, have been at it before Donald Trump became president, and they'll be at it long after he's gone. As the demographic crisis for white people becomes more stark and more apparent, you're going to see more of this activity. We're just at the beginning of a curve of bad activities.
And again, I'm speaking with Leonard Zeskind, who's the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who has worked for more than three decades to curb the influence of racism, anti-Semitism, and white supremacist groups in the United States, and is a lifetime member of the NAACP. He's the author of Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream, and he has an article at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, Standing at the Crossroads, an analysis of events in Charlottesville, Virginia.
I'm also a MacArthur scholar. MacArthur Foundation Fellow, what they call.
Well, congratulations, Leonard. And
that happened a while back.
Well, but when you say you're warning us that this is going to get worse because a lot of white people in this country simply can't get their heads around the idea that merely being born white will no longer confer privilege. And how do you educate everybody that we ought to have a different standard for how we're judged. If you expect privilege by merely being born white and it's no longer going to work for you, then you're going to have to earn privilege through your deed, your acts, and your efforts, surely. I mean, how isn't this an opportunity to change the whole paradigm?
Well, I think that we're working, all of us in different ways are working to educate people. One thing I might add today, next year is the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is the amendment that embodies the birthright citizenship and equality before the law. It's been hated by white supremacists in every generation. And I might remind you that Plessy v. Ferguson put it out of commission for a long time, and it was only the decision in the Topeka Brown case that brought it back, that brought the 14th Amendment back. These people want to put it to sleep again. Now, I think commemorating the 14th Amendment in every corner, every little village, every little public library, and having commemorations is a good way to start to cut out their claim on the Constitution and American heritage. Because American heritage is the 14th Amendment, not the Confederate Army.
So, since our history has been whitewashed of the Civil War, at least in the attempt has
or
been...
Rewritten.
And clearly, this mythology of heritage, as they call it, has been inculcated in so many Americans. What can you do to re-educate people about the real Civil War?
I think that you can put the real history out there. You can commemorate the 14th Amendment. You can form local groups to stand up to the racists when they organize their public events. And I'm not in favor of going down and screaming at them. That doesn't do as much good as I would like it to do. But I think what we do have to do is stand up, make a public voice, and let these people know we're not accepting them. And if that can be done everywhere, not just in Charlottesville, which is a little liberal village in Virginia, but everywhere, then we might move forward. But unfortunately, too many people in the mainstream and the liberals and the left, they think this is a diversion. They think that, well, we really shouldn't talk about this. We got more important things to do. There's nothing important will get done in a progressive and political fashion as long as these white nationalists have a stranglehold on American policy.
Well, but then nothing will get done if we have a president who panders to them.
Exactly. So we got work on our hands, and we should dig in and do it.
But curiously enough, the person who's been a lightning rod for a lot of criticism for his alleged racism is the White House chief strategist, Stephen Bannon. And he did an interview with the American Prospect where he described the white nationalists and neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville as a bunch of clowns, and that he thinks that Donald Trump is going to win the battle over removing these statues. He argues that Trump's position connects with the American people about their history, culture, and traditions. And he goes on to say, the race identity politics of the left, if they want to say it's racist, just give me more. Tear down more statues. Say the revolution is coming. I can't get enough of it. So here's somebody that has an obsessive hatred of the American left. And, I'm broadcasting out of the main broadcast outlet for the American left. And I can tell you from personal experience that it's not anywhere near as powerful as Stephen Bannon and these right-wingers try to, they actually are ginning up a specter that doesn't really exist.
That's not new.
Yeah, that's not new. I know. So there's some Manichaeism. I guess it's in the country's DNA. But what do you think, though, of his boasting that Trump is going to win this battle of the statues and that the left are, in effect, digging a hole for themselves?
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. It depends on what we do. If we sit back, we'll get run over. We should not forget that. We cannot sit these things out. So let's all stand up and get moving.
And in terms, though, of a strategy, if the White House...
Well, I think there's a strategy, a three-pronged strategy, if you will. First prong is chew bubble gum and walk across the room at the same time. Keep working on your progressive issues, on environmentalism or police brutality or solitary confinement or any of the numbers and numbers of issues. Keep working on them, but also keep an eye on the far right. Learn about it. Learn how it's not just the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, the Ku Klux Klan has faded out of this picture pretty much, except as a small group, and get ourselves organized. So it's walk across the room, do your progressive work, and keep an eye on this and focus on it when need be. That's the first thing. Second thing is we have to stand up and shut them down when we can and let people know what our views on these things are. The third thing we have to do is educate and organize the unorganized. There's a tremendous reservoir of unorganized people in the United States who need to be educated and brought into the battle. And it's actually those people who will decide what which way this fight goes. We should not take ourselves for granted. We should not laugh at these people in Charlottesville. They're serious ideologues. They are very serious ideologues. Some of them are National Socialists. Some are Confederate Revivalists. Some of them are white nationalists of a different stripe. Some of them follow even weirder fascist leaders from World War II than Hitler. So we've got our work to do, and you have to learn what the problem is. That's what we do at IRHR. We try and not just tell you how many hate groups. We want to get a good count on how many people they are and where they are. We did that with the Tea Parties. You can look at our site, and we have the numbers on the Tea Parties. We're going to have the numbers on the white nationalist movement. Yes, we are. And we have to know who they are, where they are, and what kind of groups they're in. And then we have to know what those groups' ideologies and strategies are, and then we have to craft our response to the actual existing problem and not make it up as if it was something from long ago and far away.
Well, Leonard Zeskind, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Leonard Zeskind, who's the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, who has worked for more than three decades to curb the influence of racism, anti-Semitism, and white supremacist groups in the United States, and is a lifetime member of the NAACP. He's the author of Blood and Politics, A History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream, and he has an article at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, Standing at the Crossroads, An Analysis of Events in Charlottesville, Virginia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the exodus of America's CEOs from Trump's Manufacturing Council and the Strategic and Policy Forum. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rashad Robinson, the Executive Director of Color of Change, a recognized expert on how popular culture impacts American attitudes and values. He has served as a thought leader, widely sought-out speaker, strategist, and leader on holding public figures accountable and utilizing media to shift public opinion concerning progressive and civil rights issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rashad Robinson.
Thanks for having me.
And well before the members of big CEOs of this country, some of the leading corporations, the heads, they were on President Trump's Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum. And he was touting, of course, when he was campaigning, Trump said, I'm a great businessman and I know all the greatest, smartest businessmen in the country, and we're going to make America great again. And now, they've all quit, and he preempted them by, knowing that they're about to quit, preempted them by closing these councils down. But well before all this happened in the wake of the outrageous events in Charlottesville, you've been on this case, Rashad, haven't you? You've been out trying to lobby these CEOs to quit well before they took a walk.
Well, absolutely. Since January, we've been both communicating with our members and engaging them in a petition campaign while also communicating behind the scenes to members of these two councils, reaching out by letters, talking to high-level officials inside the corporations at government affairs or public relations, trying to channel for them what a public campaign might look like if they choose to stay with Donald Trump. And all of this really has fit into a larger strategy that we've employed since the election of not directing our marches or our advocacy at Donald Trump, but to direct our work to the places for whom showing up actually matters, directing our advocacy and our marches to the corporations, to the media outlets, and sometimes even to our allies who need to have a stronger backbone, not at Donald Trump, but at the enablers. And these corporate leaders, by sitting on his panels, were the definition of enablers.
Well, of course, the biggest enablers are the leaders and members of the Republican House and Senate. Is there anything you can do about that?
Well, we believe that we need to continue to press on them. The more desertions and defections that we will see from corporate leaders, from cultural leaders, will hopefully send a really clear message. But we do need more patriots on the right to stand up and push back, to not just send tweets or to speak in platitudes, but to actually do real things that have consequences in holding this president accountable. The right, the members of the right, many of the Republicans in the House and the Senate, made sort of this deal, this sort of marriage of convenience between them and Donald Trump, that they will be hear no evil, speak no evil, and see no evil as long as Donald Trump advances a set of policies that sort of fits into their larger agenda of taking away the freedoms that so many of us enjoy. And so they won't speak about this sort of racist and sexist and homophobic and anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant rants. They won't talk about those things, and they'll hold their nose. And so we understand that we need to not just concentrate on Donald Trump, but to make sure that we are pinning his actions and his words directly at the members of Congress who allow him to continue in his role.
Well, I suppose there may be some jeopardy for the Republicans who have hardly a profile in courage here, except for Lindsey Graham and John McCain and a few others who've spoken out. The rest of them have been conspicuously silent. By the way, Rashad, the people to my mind who have been the most silent in America in the face of these outrages, of these hateful throwbacks, these people celebrating genocidal murderer Adolf Hitler, who killed up to 50 million people, and the leaders of the Confederacy who initiated the Civil War, that's still the greatest trauma in American history per capita. 800,000 people died on both sides, and they tore this country apart. These are not the kind of people anybody should be celebrating. And in the face of this, the religious right leaders, the Jerry Falwells, Focus on the Family, those people have been unbelievably silent. Have you noticed that?
Well, I mean, so much of the agenda of the religious right wasn't about anything that was in the Bible, but it was everything about keeping a world order that was about deeply connected to white supremacy. And so these folks are really showing their true colors, that in the face of not just all of the egregious things that Donald Trump has said, But actions he's actually talked about, from grabbing women in their private places to promoting violence and defending violence at his rallies, that we see both the religious leaders and members of the Republican Congress that seem to be more upset when President Obama wore a tan suit than when Donald Trump talked about that there might be good Nazis marching with, you know, in Charlottesville.
Let's go through the chronology here, Rashad, because it's very interesting. People that we weren't aware of actually seem to have been the first to feel uncomfortable. On Sunday night, the CEO of PepsiCo apparently began to ask other members of these councils whether staying tied to Donald Trump was a good idea. And that also, and by Monday morning, the CEO of General Motors, Mary Barra, and the IBM CEO, Ginni Rometty, had joined with the PepsiCo CEO, but it was only Monday morning that the first person actually publicly quit, and that was Merck's CEO, Kenneth Frazier, who Donald Trump immediately attacked on Twitter, which, of course, people noticed the fact that he was totally silent about what had happened with these Nazis in Charlottesville, but he hadn't said a word to condemn them. But, you know, within, I think, 30 or 40 minutes of Ken Frazier resigning, he tweeted out nasty tweets against this very prominent African-American CEO. Had you already, do you know about the earlier moves on the part of PepsiCo's GMs and IBM's CEOs?
Absolutely, and we were targeting those corporations both publicly and privately. But actually, you know, just to step back for one quick second, there were two separate councils. There was a manufacturing council, and there was sort of a more of a strategy and policy council that was, you know, kind of called the business council. And actually, the first groups to leave the business council happened some time ago. And shortly after the Muslim ban is actually when we launched our campaign. And the first corporation to leave was actually Uber, in the height of much of the sort of public pressure on Uber, where we both communicated behind the scenes and in front, pushing Uber. Then moving from Uber, focusing attention on Disney, which then also left. Elon Musk at Tesla also left after Donald Trump's announcement around the U.S.'s exit from the climate treaty. And so there were a couple of corporations that left, you know, a while ago. And then, in many ways, Russia and a number of other things took center stage. There weren't real meetings of this commission, of these councils, and so it became hard for us to sort of leverage attention because they were sort of under the radar. And then once we got reengaged, as in the lead up around both the announcements and conversations around affirmative action, around the military ban of transgender people, all these things kept coming up for us where we started reaching back out to these corporations that we had previously not heard from. Once the events of Charlotte happened, we kind of gave the corporations like a final notice while starting to move on them publicly. And that's when many of these corporations started to leave. And we had been in conversation with senior-level folks at Pepsi over the weekend while they were also trying to figure out how to get out of it. And so there was a lot of pressure that was put both publicly and privately. And this campaign has been ongoing. And we recognize that there will be other ways in which corporations who come into our communities and say, buy our products or use our services, those corporations will be trying to collude with this administration under the cover of dark. And we basically say to them is that you can't come for our money by day and work to advance policies that make us unsafe and put us in harm's way by night.
And in terms of the most prominent person, at least in this recent exodus, Merck's CEO, Kenneth Frazier, a very prominent African-American CEO, had you had any dealings with him? Had you tried to lobby him before he took an exit?
We had no direct conversations with Merck, but we did reach out through letter and writing and sort of engage them on what the campaign would look like. We never spoke with anyone there about it. And we're both surprised, and I say pleasantly surprised, to see a CEO of a corporation that isn't as public-facing as many of the other corporations that exited. Oftentimes, it's the public-facing companies, the sort of Pepsis, you know, like the Walmarts, the companies that face consumer pressure. The first two companies were Uber and Disney, both very public-facing companies. Oftentimes, companies that have a different type of non-public industry, whether it's business-to-business, drug companies, utility companies, those are much harder oftentimes to convince to exit, especially to convince them to exit something problematic first, because they're just the metrics behind their bottom line is different.
Well, there's an assumption that Kenneth Frazier, being an African-American, simply just couldn't stomach the racism of these disgusting Nazis. And by the way, I recommend, and you've probably seen it, Rashad, this Vice News profile of what really happened. They embedded did you see it? They embedded
I did see it, yes. It's hard to watch, but I think it's important to watch.
Well, exactly, and it's what they should force President Trump to watch, because he said he's seen all the footage and still insisted there were fine people on both sides. Whereas the poison that they were spewing forth, these neo-Nazis, was so extraordinary, and there's no question about their hatred. So the fact that they have such violent, hateful attitudes towards African-Americans, but they also expressed violent, hateful attitudes towards Jews. In specifically, one of them attacked Jared Kushner, and by extension, Donald Trump, for allowing his daughter to marry a Jew. We get a lot of reports about how the people that were standing by Trump in Trump Tower when he went off and showed his true colors and unmasked himself and showed us for the first time who this man is in public, how he behaves in private, which we've only heard whispers about. Standing next to him, of course, was Gary Cohen, who's Jewish, and also Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, of course, who hasn't said a thing because he's such a pathetic toady. But still, this is having an impact, is it not? I mean, amongst these CEOs, was race a factor, race and ethnicity, and being personally insulted?
I think personally insulted was definitely part of it. These folks have to go home to their families and go home to their communities and look themselves in the mirror. I also know that part of our strategy is also engaging and asking employees of these groups to speak out, of these companies to speak out. And in a world where you have an increasingly diverse employee base, of people willing to speak out and raise their voices, especially young people and millennials in the workplace. We were also very much trying to engage them to speak out and raise their voices about these things. One of the points that we had made to many of the business folks that we had reached out to was, you know, that image of Trump advisor with a Nazi pin on inside the White House. And we'd ask people, you know, very clearly, would you allow your employees to wear a Nazi pin to work into your offices? And these corporate leaders would oftentimes say things to us like, hey, don't you really want someone like us at the table? You know, being at the table means that we're going to be able to influence things. It was exactly part of the line that Elon Musk used. It was very much part of what we heard over and over again. And what we said back as we reached out to them, as each new thing came out of the administration, is, you know, were you at the table when Donald Trump decided to remove the United States from the climate treaty? And does that fit into your values? Were you at the table when Donald Trump decided with a tweet to ban trans people from the military service? And was the people that were at that table, were they the same people that decided to sponsor pride parades from your corporation? Were you at the table when he decided to roll back or talk about rolling back affirmative action? Or are those the same people that talk about diversity on panels or promote diversity through your ads? You cannot speak out of both sides of your mouth, and we had to force them to make a choice. And that was really part of the strategy, and the strategy was important because it allowed everyday people who were outraged about what they were seeing, who were angry and frustrated, an outlet to actually do something, to make their voices heard in a strategic way. And that's what we're going to continue to do through our campaigns. And so I hope for folks who are listening, who want to join us in this effort and engage, that they visit us at colorofchange.org. You know, colorofchange.org is a place where you can join us in these campaigns. You can find out more about what we're doing, but really giving people the most strategic outlets to hold the enablers of this administration accountable, and thereby cutting off their ability to be able to continue to advance some of the horrible things that are happening.
Well, just in closing, Rashad Robinson, you mentioned wearing Nazi pins to work, and I assume you're referring to Sebastian Gorka.
Absolutely.
In the White House. But did he actually wear a Nazi pin in the White House? I thought he wore a medal from a neo-fascist Hungarian group called Vitézi Rend that he claimed his father was awarded, and he was doing it to honor his father. But it's a noxious organization. There's no question about it. They were very pro-Nazi and anti-Semitic. But that's my understanding. He wore that to the inaugural ball, the Trump's inaugural ball. But has Sebastian Gorka actually worn any Nazi insignias?
So, I mean, and that's what I was talking about. I was talking about the pictures that appeared of him wearing his that pin,
right,
both at the ball and to work.
I see. And to work.
Yes.
Well, it's amazing that the kind of people that Trump has around him, you cannot believe that. You'd have to really scour the bottom of the barrel to find these people in this country. They do not represent America. And those people that showed up with guns and hate and spouting blood and soil and Jews will not replace us in Charlottesville, what percentage of the country are they? Why is this man, our president, pandering to them and not the rest of us?
You know, in some ways, you know, after elections, we see that many presidents work really hard to pull in the people who didn't vote for them or try to pull as many of those folks over. It's oftentimes why, right after elections, presidential approval ratings go up for a while as presidents are really trying to consolidate. And that's the exact opposite. President Trump has always treated people who didn't vote for him as the enemy. And over time, we're recognizing that a lot of people held their nose and voted for him. Many of them didn't want to vote for his opponent. Many of them were Republicans and kind of came home at the end. Many of them felt some need for a change, didn't fully believe that Trump was going to do all the things that he was saying, kind of thought him as an entertainment. And then there are a host of people in this country who are white supremacists, who are racist, who are sexist, and who believe in what Donald Trump believes in. And those people are going to be his most ardent supporters. And right now he is playing to them, and he is playing to them and speaking to them in deep and clear ways. And no one should be fooled about who Donald Trump wakes up each morning trying to serve.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rashad Robinson.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rashad Robinson, who's the executive director of Color of Change, a recognized expert on how popular culture impacts American attitudes and values. He has served as a thought leader, widely sought out speaker, strategist, and leader on holding public figures accountable and utilizing media to shift public opinion concerning progressive and civil rights issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.